Let's start off with a little bit of background information. Could you state your full name?
Guy Chauvin.
And your date and place of birth?
Oh gosh, 4th of October, 1936, Montreal.
Montreal. Okay, could you describe your educational background?
I went to school, educated in French, took first year in, high school in Mont-Saint-Louis, and then first year engineering at L'École Polytechnique, and switched to McGill University into the commerce program.
Yeah.
Got a BCom degree. Then I was into the Navy, got a number of naval courses and training and all this kind of stuff in various places, Montreal, Portsmouth in England, and various other bits of training. Then I came to Halifax, or I was in Halifax, and I started an MA program at Dalhousie University, MA in political science. My commerce degree was honors economics and political science. Public administration was the political science thing, but I did mostly history of political thought courses. So. And so Dalhousie, then I left the Navy and got a job teaching here without having finished my master's degree yet. In those days, that was the 1960s, the middle, late 60s, the university was expanding. Universities all across the country were expanding tremendously, and you could get a job provided you more or less said, well, I'm really interested in scholarship or something. And as I said, I'd done quite a bit of the coursework towards the MA, and I finished my MA, and then I taught here for a number of years, and then I took leave. I took 3 years leave. And went and did a PhD, or did the residency requirement for a PhD, and came and completed it. Did that at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland.
Okay. So how many years have you been associated with St. Mary's?
25.
25? And has, what capacity were you, firstly, were you a lecturer?
I was a lecturer, yes.
Okay. So how has your role at St. Mary's changed over time?
My role hasn't changed much. I still teach much. You know, the role hasn't changed much. I've become involved in faculty affairs to a greater extent than I was when I first came here. I showed no interest whatsoever. I come from military, the hierarchy, and so on of the military. I wasn't likely to be a disruptive influence, I guess. I followed orders and that kind of thing. And this was a very paternalistic organization at that time. It was run by the Jesuit fathers, sort of thing. And, but gradually I got involved in politics as various things happened to friends of mine and so on. And I got drawn into faculty politics, and now I'm president of the faculty union. So and I've been president of the faculty union on and off for many years. So I suppose that in that sense my role has changed, and that I've become much more involved in faculty affairs.
You were quite involved in the institution of the union, weren't you?
Yeah, well, the institution of the union, I was on the QP side. I mean, there was a fight as to how this place would unionize. I was in favor of unionizing, but I was in the QP camp of those who wanted to unionize through QP rather than CAUT. CAUT had no experience in unions. We were the first, we weren't quite the first. There was a union before ours, certified in British Columbia, in the days when you could have unions in British Columbia, at Nelson of British Columbia, which was a small university which has, after it unionized, was closed by the government. It was the Skiers University, and Nancy Green and various other famous Canadian skiers did their studies at Nelson of British Columbia in those days, because it was up in the mountains, and it was a great place for skiing up in the Rockies, and they would study and ski. But it was a very small university, and that was the first in English-speaking Canada. There were syndicats in Quebec, but there were no unions, English-speaking unions, before Nelson of BC, and we were the next. We haven't been closed yet, so.
Well, that's good. So what changes took place after the union came in?
Well, many of the changes had taken place before the union came in. I mentioned earlier that this was a rather paternalistic organization. It was run by Jesuit priests who are the soldiers of Christ sort of thing, running things on a fairly militaristic line. And there was, you know, the president, the very Reverend Father President sort of thing, or Dr. Father President, and so on. And there were lots of priests teaching here at the time. As that control slipped, there was a bit of a vacuum created. I mean, as the university became laicized, and there were some problems. Some of the, face it, some of the Jesuits had certain problems towards the end. There was a shortage, I guess, of young priests coming in, and some of the priests were doing fairly strange things. I mean, they were, for a variety of reasons. A great deal of the church was going through some problems, I think, the Catholic Church at the time. There were a lot of priests leaving, becoming laicized and so on. And the Jesuits found themselves, I think, without the staffing to run the university. And as a result of that, it went to become, became a lay institution, become laicized. And there was simply a bit of a vacuum. We had a faculty manual, and I remember working on the faculty manual for long hours, drafting the faculty manual, which was sort of the rules by which we would live, sort of thing. How the administration would treat faculty and how the faculty would respond and so on. And we worked long periods of long evenings. I can remember working long evenings with the then chair of the psychology department and the then dean of engineering. We had a dean of engineering in those days. And we worked on a mutually agreeable faculty manual, which would govern the faculty association, which we then had, and in its relationships with the administration. And we then got our first lay president, who came here and more or less told us that this faculty manual wasn't worth the paper it was printed on. As far as he was concerned, it wasn't a legal document and he didn't intend to be bound by it. Now, the Jesuit priest, last Jesuit president, Father Labelle, had more or less agreed, and that was why we had a dean of engineering representing the administration on this team that was negotiating this. And we were sort of told it, you know, wasn't going to count for anything. And that's really what began the process of thinking about the union. And it took some time, took about 5 years, I suppose, somewhere around 5 years, 4 or 5 years, to go from that to actually taking action to unionize the place. Because, again, because there was no experience. Nowadays, universities, you know, as soon as the shoe drops, they go in and unionize, sort of thing. But in those days, how do you do it in a university? You know, there was Nelson, British Columbia, not an encouraging example, having been shut down by the BC government. But having been told the faculty manual had no legal standing and the president didn't intend to be bound by it, we were looking, you know, what could we have that would bind the administration? What would create an ordered universe within which we could operate instead of arbitrariness from the top? And the Jesuits were very paternalistic, but they were very kind as well. I mean, they were professionally charitable people. We weren't that sure about the late president. We suspected that he didn't exercise him kind. And let's face it, the Jesuits, a few people had been let go for a variety of reasons. And the faculty was somewhat unhappy. I mean, some of them were perhaps justified. I mean, people being not renewed and so on. But there was no process. There was no procedure. They didn't know how this was done, how these decisions were arrived at. These people simply didn't get their contract renewed or were told to leave or were bought out. And we weren't sure how this was happening. We just knew that these people disappeared and some of them weren't happy to disappear. So there was something a little bit strange there. We had two cases about that time of people who had to leave the university or who left. You know, we're not sure exactly what negotiations took place. I mean, this was part of the problem. All of this was done behind closed doors and so on. But one of them was someone I shared this office with. I wouldn't think there's room here. Two, but when I first came here, I shared an office. We used to share offices, at least two to an office. And a professor of sociology here I shared an office with, and he had to go, and, you know, might have been quite justified, but we just didn't know. We didn't know if it was justified or not. We didn't have the evidence. I mean, we were simply told the president had more or less told them to go, and he did go. He got a job somewhere else, so there's, you know, it wasn't a matter of tremendous hardship for him, but it was disquieting to see these kinds of decisions coming down. Now, those came down with the last of the Jesuit fathers. And we were even more suspicious of the lay president. We just didn't know where we would, where there was an appeal if these kinds of decisions were made and so on. And he did come in here like gangbusters, the first president, the first lay president, announcing that he was going to fire all sorts of people and so on. So that had panicked the faculty. And it's quite remarkable when I say this is the first university in English-speaking Canada, or now the oldest union, other than Nelson, British Columbia, the oldest union in English-speaking Canada, that this was a faculty that had, you know, grown up as a in a paternalistic environment, run from the top by the, you know, very reverend father, Dr. President, sort of thing, running the show. It was a faculty that was older than the average in university faculties. It had more religious than the average. More people were still Jesuits and so on. It was a Catholic, fairly conservative faculty and so on. And yet, you know, we unionized first, which is, you know, just indicates how much of a radicalizing experience this was, this tossing away of the faculty manual and the rather cavalier attitude towards fire. I mean, announcing that 14 people are going to be fired and so on. So eventually, the faculty got itself organized, formed a union, held a vote of non-confidence in the president, and the president was told by Senate that Senate didn't want him as chair anymore, and all this worked its way through, and he finished his term, but without academic responsibilities in the last year of the term. He just served out his term. And that was it. I mean, we had a union, we were organized, and then the union movement started gathering speed at other universities. I mean, Nova Scotia now, St. Francis Xavier is not unionized, but I think it would unionize. You know, it knows the way to do it. I mean, it would do it at a drop of a hat if it felt that it happened to be necessary. It may never become necessary because administrations may say, well, we'll treat the faculty. Well, they wind up negotiating salaries and so on. Here, you know, salaries, again, were sort of manna from heaven. I mean, we found out, we got a little letter every year that told us what our salary was going to be for the next year. And we said, thank you very much. Now we negotiate those things. But even in X, which is not unionized, the one non-unionized university in the province, negotiate salaries. They have committees that meet with committees of the board and so on. So they act almost as a certified unionized university, though they are not. But everybody, you know, both sides know that if the relationship sours, they'll unionize like that.
So relations changed after the explaining.
Well, relations changed from what they'd been just before unionization. I think to some extent they restored some faculty control over academic areas and so on, defined the relationship better. It became less arbitrary. I mean, the problem was arbitrariness. You know, there was a Senate, and there continued to be a Senate after unionization, and the Senate decided academic issues. It had decided academic issues before, but it was just that now it no longer was arbitrary, or not everything was arbitrary. There were steps to be taken, and established steps, recognized steps, and that it made for a more formal relationship. And as I say, it's even affected, you see, those universities that are not certified as trade unions, even those universities behave much more as unionized universities. The universities out west, they can't unionize in Alberta and British Columbia. British Columbia, I think there's a move to change that with the new government, but Alberta, they can't form trade unions. But boy, they sure work like trade unions. You know, the universities there tend to have professional officers for their associations and so on. and they negotiate. It's just not on a certified basis. So that the whole climate of how these things are determined, how salaries are arrived at, and how relationships between the employer and or the administration and the faculty are, so have changed across the country, whether the universities are unionized or not. But we were part of the movement, and very early part of the movement. Shortly after us, within a few months, there were universities in Ontario that began to do this, and so on, and it spread fairly rapidly across the country. I suppose the expansion had a lot to do with it, the expansion of universities. I mentioned, you know, I came in here, and you just had to say, oh yeah, I'd like to teach. You know, look at me, here I am, and you'd be hired type of thing. You know, it wasn't as it is today. And you didn't have to have much by way of qualifications or anything like that. So the rapid expansion changed the nature of universities. They became much larger enterprises than they had been. And I think that complicated the administration of universities. Religious universities, there aren't very many that are still, you know, clearly religiously affiliated. I mean, even X, which is the last one here to change, but they now have a lay president at X, and the Mount has a lay president. We have a lay president here. You know, there are not too many that have retained that religious character. St. Thomas More in Saskatchewan, but it's part of the University of Saskatchewan, basically. I mean, there are some religiously affiliated colleges, Anglican, Lutheran, and so on. But the character of universities has changed. They've become more of a business and so on. And governments have wanted more accountability, and more accountability has meant growing administrations, more financial officers, and so on. The universities are watched more carefully, but that means they have more, you know, the faculty become concerned as to how the money is spent. How much is going to faculty development, teaching resources, and this kind of stuff, and how much is going to the control function in the university. And the control function has mushroomed. It has grown tremendously. And it's not entirely the fault of administration. I mean, as a union president, I sort of take the view that it's all due to the administration. But the reality is that much of it is due to government demanding greater accountability on the part of the universities for the money that government provides. I mean, government pays the lion's share of university education. You know, it's not students that pay the lion's share. Students here pay a fairly high proportion at St. Mary's of the cost of their education, but the government still pays most of it. And the governments are, well, you know, the climate today, and we, you know, we had all this talk of rationalization and the like. We've changed governments, and I think that'll change the climate a little bit. There's still going to be insistence that the government will want to know that it's not wasting its money by pouring it into universities. Ironically, that doesn't always mean that there's more money being put into the teaching function, because if you demand more accountability, you have more people who account for the money. So you need business offices, mushroom, and all sorts of those ancillary, in a sense, ancillary operations mushroom faster than the growth in faculty in very many cases. We've seen that as a bit of a problem.
Okay, let's move on to academic changes that you've noticed over the years. Course offerings and changes in academic programs, those kind of things.
Oh, well, there are changes in an academic program. I mean, some things have changed, some things have changed for a number of reasons. Certainly there's been a big development in the Faculty of Commerce in this university, you know, where accounting has grown. But Faculty of Commerce has always been a major area of of St. Mary's. But when I came to St. Mary's 25 years ago, there were, there was an additional faculty, I guess it was Faculty of Engineering, had a Dean of Engineering. And then it became a division and was folded into the Faculty of Science. But then there was, when I first came, it was Arts and Science. That was one faculty. It was Commerce, Engineering, Arts and Science, and Education. And of course, Arts and Science was by far the biggest faculty, bringing in both Arts and Science. And there was one Dean of Arts and Science who, ironically enough, was an engineer, though he wasn't Dean of Engineering. So there have been a few changes like that. I mean, engineering has disappeared as a faculty, and arts and science have become split into two. The faculty are far better trained today. There are a far higher proportion of people with PhDs, for instance, than there were in those days. In fact, we have a very good record in terms of faculty qualifications here at St. Mary's. Most of our people have PhDs. That has been a development as well in the Faculty of Commerce. For instance, a few years ago, you know, when one was absolutely amazed to see somebody with a PhD in accounting, for instance. Nowadays, you know, a high proportion of the commerce of the Department of Accounting, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what numbers, but a fairly high proportion have PhDs in accounting. So there has been that change, that the faculty has become far more professional or far more highly trained over the years. Certain areas have emerged, new areas, international development studies, women's studies, Atlantic Canada studies, you know, there have been some area studies that have developed. Others have disappeared. We once had a Western European studies program that has vanished. So these things, to some extent, come and go, I guess, with momentary enthusiasms of the vulgar multitude or something like that. So a few things have disappeared. Many things have been gained. It's not that easy. I mean, it's not the university that decides, you know, we're going to offer this. You have to get the sanction of the Maritime Provinces Higher Education Commission, and there are lots of hoops to go through. Again, a question of accounting for government money. The government wants to know what its money is going to be spent on. So if you want to start a new program, you have to propose it to the Maritime Provinces Higher Education Commission, get approval, and so on. Certainly there are, you know, trendy areas that develop in departments, and departments go in for something for a while, and maybe then they become less trendy and get dropped, sort of thing. We haven't taught a course in Soviet politics for a few years in this department, for instance. Well, you know, there isn't the Soviet Union anymore. We have the courses on the books, but you know, who's going to teach? Well, partly it's the resources of the department. We don't have somebody who's an expert. But at the moment, we don't look very hard for somebody who could come in and teach Soviet politics, because it's gone. You know, it's not there anymore. Mm. But sometimes your teaching is governed by the interests of the interests and the competence of the people you have in the department. I mean, you can't mount courses in, even if, say, in literature, or in a particular era of literature, unless you've got somebody who studied that era of literature. You know, if you had no one who'd ever read Chaucer in the English department, they couldn't teach a course on Chaucer. So at one stage we had somebody here who's quite familiar with the Middle East, and we had regularly had courses on Middle Eastern politics. We're interested in that area, because that's certainly not an area that has faded. I mean, you have the conferences now going on between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and tripartite talks sponsored by the Americans, sort of thing, to try and resolve the problems of Palestinians in Israel. So that's still a very interesting area, but we don't have anybody at the moment on staff who knows very much about the Middle East. Maybe as part of a foreign policy course, you touch on it or something like that, or international relations, but we don't have anybody that's a specialist in Middle Eastern politics or has that as one of a series of specialties. Maybe we will. So there are changes like that, which are not deliberate matters of choice. You know, it's not the department going and saying, well, we want to teach a course in this, we'll hire in that area. You do that occasionally when it's considered very important. But some of the other, I mean, we could not conceivably in the political science department have no one teaching Canadian politics, for instance. That would be inconceivable. If we found that we had no one to teach Canadian politics, we'd certainly be, you know, with a vacancy, we'd certainly be going to hire in that area and insist that area be covered. But some of the other areas that departments cover are sometimes a matter of accident more than design. Now, the changes that have occurred. Engineering has changed largely because it changed across the province. I mean, part of the change in, you know, from it being a faculty to it being a division is that initially 3 years of engineering was done at the satellite campuses, in a sense, and then you went and did 2 years at TUNS, or as it then was, the technical, what was it, the Nova Scotia Tech, I guess. What was it called? Gosh, it's amazing. I forget. What became TUNS, anyway? And now TUNS does 3 years, and the subsidiary satellite campuses do 2 years. So that's part of the reason for downgrading it from a faculty, because, you know, it's doing a program of virtually equal length to the other areas. So that kind of thing has changed. And there have been changes in emphasis, for instance, in the Faculty of Education. I would think they've done a lot more with graduate students, graduate degrees in education, than they used to, because the teacher market is fairly well supplied at the moment, I guess, except for physics and French or something like that, the two F subjects. But so they train fewer, proportionately at any rate, fewer undergraduate teachers, but more for upgrading of teachers who are already in the system and coming to get Masters of Education, Masters of Arts in Education. Again, that the degree has changed. There used to be just an MA in Education. Now there's a Master of Education, which is without thesis and so on. We probably give more master's degrees than we used to. We have developed the Department of Astronomy, which didn't exist. Well, it was physics and astronomy when I first came here. I think they had one astronomer and the rest were physicists. Now it's become, it's again astronomy and physics now, but it's, I think it's astronomy and physics rather than physics and astronomy. They get that kind of change. That is a fairly new program. Certainly the MBA is, you know, something that was developed. Certain master's degrees have emerged in that way. So the offerings of the university are a little bit wider, a little bit larger. International Development Studies, I mentioned, that was a new area that came in and certainly developed. The Masters of Psychology, is a, you know, there have been some growth in graduate programs, though we have continued to concentrate on undergraduate education. And people worry about that. I mean, people are worried about, or some people, I don't imagine all of them are, but some people are worried about the proposal, for instance, for a PhD in accounting, which has been put forward, that, you know, this will detract from teaching undergraduates. And Nova Scotia universities have done reasonably well in attracting students from outside, largely, I think, because they're small, because people like coming here for undergraduate degrees. I mean, it's not just St. Mary's. I mean, that's True Acadia, X. So we do, the province of Nova Scotia imports more students than any other province in the country, proportionately. I mean, a higher proportion of our students are from outside Nova Scotia than anywhere else, which leads to financial problems in terms of funding and so on. But that, I think, is because we're small universities that offer perhaps a more intimate atmosphere for undergraduates. They do meet the prof who teaches the course rather than a graduate teaching assistant who's finishing his PhD thesis and you know, really would like to get back to chapter two rather than talk to a student and so on.
So what differences have you noticed in the student population over the years?
Oh, well, they you know, there are obviously moods that sweep through. I mean, I came here in the 60s, and I was here in the late 60s, which was the period of student rebellion, demonstrations, food demonstrations, people picking up their lunches and dumping them all in giant garbage bags out what was then the parking lot is now the library. You know, there was quite a bit of this kind of stuff going on, student rebellion and so on, and that died down, and we haven't seen much of that student radicalism since. Students, well, I suppose we always, every year we tend to complain that students can't write, that they're worse than they ever were and so on. I'm not sure about that. But you talk to high school teachers and so on. I mean, there has been a change in terms of the reading and writing, I think, which has obviously affected universities. That's on the academic side of students. But I think the television culture and so on, I mean, the visual culture has affected retarded a bit the ability to read and write. I think it's had an impact on that. So we do tend to exaggerate, I think, the ignorance of students when they arrive and their awful writing styles and so on. But the students now, partially because of the economy, or probably mainly because of the economy, are more concerned about, you know, what they're going to do when they come out. Is there going to be a job there and so on? Whereas students in the late 60s were not that concerned. I mean, they knew there was a job out there. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, and that's even going considerably further back, but when I was an undergraduate taking a commerce degree, we had a course on Saturday mornings that I can remember, which was commercial law. Commercial law was Saturday mornings on your final year. It was from 9 to 12, and that's the only time you got it. So people did show up. But when we came out at 12, there were people waiting outside from brokerage firms and trust companies and so on, because we were commerce students, saying, can we buy you lunch, you know, and so on. They want to talk to you about hiring you, giving you a job. And that would start, you know, at the beginning of the year, they'd be enticing you to go and work for them and so on. Well, pretty different, or very different today. So I think students have become very concerned, and they don't want to rock the boat to a greater extent than they used to. So you don't get the student radicalism that there was in the 60s. I don't think it was particularly bad here at St. Mary's, but we did have student radicals. I can remember a few names, which I won't put on records, of students who were leaders of some kind of student rebellion on campus, and it upset some members of faculty. It upset many members of faculty. It didn't upset me particularly. At one stage, I think I was the only faculty member who talked to these people, but they used to come and see me and spend time in my office, and sometimes I told them that what they were doing was stupid, but they said, well, we have to do it, you know. It was sort of the story of the French Revolution, and one of the French revolutionary leaders who saying, you know, the mob is marching and I am their leader, I must go and you know, take the front row type of thing. Yeah. So it was that kind of thing at times. That has quieted down. We haven't seen it again. I imagine one of these days that kind of thinking will come again, you know, but it just hasn't cropped up. Other changes, of course, specifically at St. Mary's, is that St. Mary's was initially an all-male institution when I first came here. There were very few female students. There were part-timers. I mean, the only females were part-time students. And most of us had one or two in a class. I mean, today, you know, half your students, well, I suppose a slightly larger. I mean, it's almost a representation of the population at large, a 52% women. Though for different reasons, because in the population at large, it's because they live longer, but more old ladies than you have old men, sort of thing, you know, more old gents. But that has changed considerably. I mean, the sea of faces you see before you in a class, that has changed. Many more female students. I tend to see, I wouldn't want to describe them as more serious students, because a lot of the student rebellion and so on had a serious purpose. I mean, they had a lot of fun doing it, I suspect, but it was a bit of a rebellion against the society and so on, and society's accommodated them to some extent. I mean, part of it was, you know, there was a regulation here, you had to wear a jacket and tie to go to class. Now, that was in the days of the all-male class. Some people come without shirts. I mean, that was the way you rebelled, but you still came with a jacket and a tie. No shirt, no trousers or something. That has changed. I mean, there's no dress code nowadays. You know, when you see somebody coming up with coming to class with a tie or a jacket or a female student coming in with a dress and so on, you know they're headed for an interview. they're going for a job interview that day, sort of thing. So it's not the standard anymore. But that was part of it, breaking down those rules, which, you know, I'm not sure what relevance they really had, you know, except to say, well, you know, once you get out into the business world, you may have to wear a three-piece suit type of thing, but well, why do you have to, you know, you don't have to practice for years to learn how to wear a three-piece suit. You know? That seemed to be the thinking, that, oh yes, you're going to be a university graduate, you'll get a job with, you know, an insurance company or something like that, and you'll have to wear a suit, so you got to start practicing. You know? get years of practice of doing up your buttons. I mean, so there wasn't much rationale behind those kinds of rules, and some of them have been kicked aside. I mean, the important rules are the academic regulations, not the, and even some of those are sometimes a little bit strange, you know, but tends to be those that are important more so than the rules about dress code and that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think the rebellion of the 60s did break down that insistence on short haircuts and that kind. It was a little bit like being in the military. The rules were not enforced as stringently, but that has changed as a result, I think, of the rebellion of the 1960s. But they certainly didn't become, they wanted to change the world, and that didn't work very well. And someday somebody will come along and want to change the world again. And I think every time there's one of these movements, it gets very disappointed because it never accomplishes what it set out to do. But it makes a few changes, and then retreats and becomes discouraged and joins conforming multitude and so on, ultimately. I mean, strange to think of some of those people. I mean, some of those people who were student rebels, who now are deputy ministers and politicians, very conventional and so on. I know one of them who became a deputy minister, they've changed a lot in those years. But there's always a need, I think, for somebody. And I think we lack that today. I think because of the economic circumstances, because students are worried about whether they're going to get a job, and let's not have any black marks against our name, and let's make sure we get top-notch letters of reference saying we are polite, and all this kind of stuff. You do miss the challenge that there should be to all sorts of things that should be challenged out there in society, the homelessness and the single parents and the lack of funding for all sorts of things, and the misery that exists in our society. I mean, a recent report saying that we're not treating children well in Canada, we're not looking after the welfare of children well. Well, I mean, that should upset students. I mean, this is the stage that people should be able to become upset with that. But one of the problems is students work too much, I think, today. They don't sit around and get indignant and work on each other and work themselves up because they have to go and sling hash at McDonald's or something like that. Oh, have we stopped?
No. Okay. Just checking.
They have to go and sling hash at McDonald's or work as a bartender or a bouncer or a waitress or something like that. Students are losing part of their education because of that, and that's most unfortunate. But we contribute to that by raising fees all the time. I mean, fees are becoming higher and higher. That makes life very, very difficult. And I'm quite convinced that students do lose a significant element of their education by having to do that. When I was an undergraduate, we might work one night a week or something like that, or we'd be in the military and get paid as a reservist for one or two nights a week and a weekend every four or something like that. Mm-hmm. We didn't need that much money. We were probably more affluent than many of the students that come to university today, but also the fees, I think, proportionately were considerably lower. And we used to, after class, I can remember the McGill Tea Room. That was what I was at McGill, and I remember going to the McGill Tea Room, and we'd sit there, and sure, we'd joke and so on, but we'd also discuss Joseph Schumpeter's Socialism, Communism, and Democracy, which happened to be one of the textbooks in one of our economics courses, which was a very stimulating textbook and so on. And we'd talk about the arguments. So we learned more, I think, doing that, rehearsing the arguments we'd heard, rehearsing our profs' commentary on the ideas of Schumpeter and so on, than we did in class. But we needed the class to provide the commentary that we would then hash over and discuss and so on. If you have to go down to McDonald's, 20 minutes after you finish the end of class, and you sling hamburgers for 3 hours or something like that, and then you come, you've forgotten what you got at that lecture. I mean, you're not. And that's an important part of education. I think people are missing out on that today. And gives people a less... this would be an economics course, and we'd go after, have a cup of tea or coffee or something like that after an economics course. But there'd be engineers, there'd be all sorts of people taking an economics as an elective, and there'd be also those of us who were economics majors or honors and so on. Get people from a variety of backgrounds on discussing it from their perspective, and so on. You'd get you know, this could be a very stimulating discussion. So, okay, we'd take an hour doing that, and we'd spend half an hour discussing the lecture, or 40 minutes discussing the lecture, and 20 minutes, you know, flirting with the female students, and so on, and they with us, and all that. But we would do some of that kind of exercise, do some of that intellectual processing of the ideas we were being exposed to. And that's missing today from many students. If not most students, that kind of thing is no longer possible. So that's a change, and that's not a change for the better. On the other hand, universities offer more courses that are topical, perhaps. The programs are less rigid than they used to be. You can tailor your program to what interests you more than you could in the past. Many of the former undergraduate programs, you only had a couple of electives that were allowed. I mean, you had to take, this sort of thing. Your course was mapped out a lot more carefully and a lot more strictly than it is now. Some of that's good, some of that's not so good, because you don't necessarily get the progression of courses that you ought to have. You wind up with a salad of sometimes incompatible elements, sort of thing. But there's something to be gained, something to be lost. But it was probably too rigid. Maybe now we're not rigid enough. You know, if you take you've taken a BA, I imagine. You take a BA, and the only thing you have to take is that list. Those five courses in your first year. One humanities, two social sciences, and this and that. English 200 and. It's not 200 anymore, 201 and 202 or something like that, and either a language other than English, philosophy 200, or a natural science. Is that about it? Yeah, I guess that covers it. So that's the only rigidity, except by departments. I mean, then if you elect a major, you'll be required to take one or two courses in the department. That's about it. After that, you shop, and you can wind up with, a rather disparate... On the other hand, if you work at it carefully and plan your program well, you can wind up with a splendid succession, of course. But it leaves us more to the student than it used to be. Mm. Yeah. It's what you make of it.
Have you noticed any changes in the ethnicity and age of your students over the years?
Not all that much. We used to have... Well, you could say there are fewer, I would think there are probably fewer black students today than there were before, but that's largely because there's the fees that have been imposed on foreign students have discouraged some of the Jamaican and West Indies students from coming up. We are not getting much of the native black or indeed Mi'kmaq population. And that's a shame. I think we have to work harder at getting those people in. But raising the fees and eliminating bursaries isn't going to do it. The government, previous government, it's gone now. One shouldn't say evil things about a deceased government, I guess. But I think what they did with eliminating the bursaries was hard on those people. A large number of studies have indicated that people who are poor are more reluctant to go into debt than the middle classes, sort of thing. Great uneasiness about debt. And let's face it, people who, the black indigenous population of Nova Scotia, as a result of massive discrimination and so on over many years of racism and so on, tends to be poor. The Preston area is not the south end of Halifax. I mean, they tend to be poor out there. And they're going to be very, even more reluctant, I think, to come to university when there's no bursary, or when the bursary is subject to taking a large loan, and to face being in debt when you come out of university. That tends to upset people. So I don't think that's been constructive in terms of attracting those people. The middle class, put more money into loans, because loans you get, or you hope to get the money back. Maybe it's cheaper for the government to provide loans than it is to provide bursaries, obviously. But I think for some of those people, this doesn't work. So there has been a change in that sense. So of course, women, you asked them, I noticed a change. Well, this is not ethnicity, but that certainly is a change. I think We've seen a few more native Mi'kmaq students in recent years, but there were some in those days as well, and they're certainly not in here in large numbers. What was the other one? You said age.
Age.
Well, there were always part-time students who were upgrading. What you see now are more mature students doing full degrees. People who take a year off or 2 years off, you know, people who've done some university and are coming back to finish a degree. And I think you see more of those today. So that the age, you tend to have mature students who are doing full. But in each individual courses, because you had part-timers who were coming in and taking one course or something like that, the change has not been remarkable. I haven't found it remarkable. I suppose possibly slightly older average age, because you do get students who are somewhat older. In the past year I've had a number of older students in various classes, I suppose. Some of them are senior citizens coming back, retired, and never had a chance to get a university education, or they got an education in something else and they'd like to get a degree in some other subject or something like that, and some of those people come back. But they weren't absent. I mean, they weren't non-existent 25 years ago. I suppose there were fewer of those 25 years ago. But you did get part-timers who'd come in to a course. So that's slightly older, yeah. Slight rise in age.
In the changes in the size of the university, have you noticed your relationship with your students changing any over the years?
Yeah, it's less intimate today, I think, than it was then. Though, you know, that's always with some students, but there were more, I think, of them who were on a very close relationship with faculty members in the past than today. Today tend to concentrate on the very good students who are going to do honors, and, you know, you have a close relationship with honor students. They're in your office all the time, and all. Less with the run-of-the-mill student, you don't look for them and they don't look for you, sort of thing. Or less than they used to, I think. That has changed a little bit. And this is not improving. I mean, the student-faculty ratio of this university is very bad in that sense. I mean, it's a very, very large student-faculty ratio. So you're getting more and more students per faculty member in the university, and that limits the opportunities for contact and the like. So that creates a bit of a distance, I suppose. Though it's still, you know, much closer than what my experience was as an undergraduate in a university with large graduate schools and lots of graduate students. As an honors student, I was entitled by right to 20 minutes every fortnight with a faculty advisor. And I'd go in and he had a big pocket watch on his desk, and when the 20 minutes came around, didn't matter if I was in the middle of a sentence or whatever, I would be told, sorry, I have another student waiting, sort of thing, and you'd have to go and be replaced by another honors student. Now, those were honors students. The ordinary undergraduate didn't get a hell of a lot of time from faculty members, yeah, and many of the courses were taught by PhD candidates and the like. The fact that we are an undergraduate institution has saved us from that fate, or saved the undergraduates here from that fate. But it's becoming more and more difficult to deal with the large numbers of students, per faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they've got to go to McDonald's, you know, and sling hash. I mean, they're not around as much as they used to be.
Okay, that's about all I wanted to cover. Is there anything else you can think that you'd like to add? Changes that you've seen over time or anything?
Oh, well, changes over time. The university's expanded. I'd like to see some more changes, obviously. I'd like to see a better library, though it's certainly improved. We have a smaller proportion of the library space is taken up with Lives of the Saints today than used to be the case 25 years ago.